marched against this war. That is one out of every 25 human beings in Britain. In Rome, as we speak, there are another 2 million people marching. And in Spain, the third of George Bush's allies in Europe, there are 1 million people marching against the war.
What's up, New York?
NBC producers that I spoke to, she said that at noon on February 15th in New York City, where all these millions of people were totally shutting down vast amount of blocks, they get a little phone call from NBC saying, cut the live feed.
Our next guest just returned from a two-week peace mission in Iraq. We want to welcome Lorna Tychonsta back to the show.
You came back from Baghdad. You stayed there for how long? 2 weeks?
I was in Baghdad.
Okay, now, in my opinion, you seem like a lovely woman, but in my opinion, your visit bordered on treason. What were you thinking going there?
Oh, please. You know, I'm an American. I have a constitution. What makes you think that I should not be able to travel someplace on this planet? We
Wait
have freedom of speech. This is a free country. You're telling me that this is treason?
If you oppose America's policies, that's fine. You can protest here all you want, because that's free speech protected under the First Amendment. That's fine.
No, I'm an American.
But to carry your protest to enemy territory when we are on the eve of war seems to me villainous and bordering on treason.
Well, that makes great play here on TV.
Was aiding and abetting the enemy?
Absolutely not. I'm an American.
My going there was illegal. So, what is it, up to $1 million and 12 years in jail for going someplace and bringing back the truth?
And I guess it comes down to the fact that if we were all sitting here and we were about to be bombed, I'd certainly want some group to rise up and make it not happen.
I'm in the process of setting up a college tour. I'll go around the country even if I have to and show these photos. And I really think that even people who want war, once they look at these photos, there will be people who will change their minds.
There's nothing in the country.
They have raw sewage floating in the streets. With such poverty, such desolation. You can see the stress in the eyes of every Iraqi person. You see this exhaustion and this fear. And the American public has to go and see. I think they have to go to Iraq and see this for themselves. Don't listen to me. You know, don't take my word on it.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. We will defend our freedom. We will bring freedom to others, and we will prevail. May God bless our country and all who defend her.
I believe in war. I believe there are times when you need to defend your land, your home. I don't think this was one of those times.
I was actually in the dark room the night that we started bombing.
It kind of stunned me that at that point, like a silence swept across the land. It stunned me that I felt I wanted to be silent too. If any of them are dead, they'll still live.
And I think that's why I made so many, so that like everybody who has them, in some way, they won't be forgotten.
I wanted it to be true, that the Iraqis were happy we were there, that the fighting was going to stop now, and that we could have peace and things would be better. Like a little kid, I wanted it to be okay.
In Baghdad today, the search continued for Iraq's weapons of mass destruction.
So growing concern here, they won't find the massive quantities of weapons that were the major justification for the war.
The one thing I felt was missing from my work were the stories of the soldiers. That summer, I drove to North Carolina, to Camp Lejeune, to interview Marines.
Half of what I do, or more than half of what I do, is because they take it to the personal. Like, I don't want my kids going to fight some old rich man's war.
Are these Americans who are so frightened that they're sending these children off to fight for them, are they willing to look at the photographs that they bring home of the dead bodies that they've killed? We don't want to look. We don't want to see. Send them off. Let somebody else fight for us so that we'll possibly say. I think that that's a crime. I think that's a criminal activity.
What do we do? You know, what do we...
We should never win.
We should never win.
Good. And just let the country be.
My son was in the invasion and when we invaded Iraq in the beginning of the war. He was a driver of a 3rd Humvee in line going to Baghdad. His battalion was part of the battalion that got pinned down in Nasiriyah for 11 days in a firefight. During the war, didn't sleep. I became a CNN Fox News addict. Finally, I just had to turn the TVs off. He came back with 11 ribbons, a lot of souvenirs, a lot of pictures, a lot of nightmares. To this day, he still has them. You don't hear anything about the guys that came back, what's missing the legs, the arms, and stuff like that. You know, there's nothing in the media, there's nothing in the newspapers, nobody talks about it. What are you going to do? You know? Say a prayer.
You know, I went in the beginning to bring home the face of the Iraqi people. Now I want to go and bring home the face of the soldiers, because that's got to hit home here.
The armored personnel vehicle that I drove around with, I went out on patrol. We left at 3 o'clock in the morning. This is probably the worst experience of my entire life. So we rode around in this heavy-duty tin can that was spewing diesel fuel out of here. Over here, there's a hatch that you can stick your head out of. You want to see the bullets and mortars coming at you. There was no heater in the vehicle. They had had a heater. It had broken. You know, these guys are driving around. It's very cold there, and they don't need your goddamn ribbon. They need you to send them some money for a heater, or at least to write your congressman and your congresswomen and say, could you please make sure our troops are being taken care of over there? And they need letters. They need emails. They love it. They want to know that America even knows they're there. So we rode around the village, you know, waiting to be shot at. You know, we got back around 11 o'clock in the next morning. That night when I tried to sleep, my body hurt more than it's ever hurt from any flu I've ever had in my entire life. And I think it was a combination of riding around in a heavy-duty tin can and also that I had poisoned myself with adrenaline. Because at any given moment, we were told, you know, we could be shot at.
How do they feel?
They're out in the streets. I spoke to some who are terrified. They're being shot at. They're under threat of mortars landing on their bases, car bombs going off around them. You know, most of the ones I spoke to want to come home. And do you know that there's a law that that the Bush administration has enforced? The Clinton administration didn't enforce it. That you cannot film or in any way capture the caskets with the flags on them. We're not allowed to see this. The media is not allowed to capture these images. That's a good question. Well, I don't know. Why? Should you not be seeing death on your TV?
This is a better life. For a better life.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to your program for a better life with me, Javed Akbari. Well, in this episode, I'm going to discuss a moral ill and, let's say, an important moral quality which is considered a negative attribute, and that is greed. Greed is a moral attribute. Some people are greedy and some are generous. Some are charitable and some are stingy. These are qualities which may exist. You might be greedy to some extent. And of course, every individual could be greedy. Greed is, let's say, a fundamental evil. In this time, in this age, all these, litigations, all these disputes, all these conflicts are nothing but a manifestation of greed. It is because of greed that humanity is at war. you know, one country attacks another country, one nation attacks another one, and of course the acts of transgressions taking place are because of greed, because some people want more. They are not contented with what they have. Greed basically is a personal evil, and it has gradually been extended to national and then international affairs. These wars, like these wars that are taking place here and there in the world, whether they are hot or cold, hot war, cold war, these, let's say, armed races and races of armaments, these international intrigues, these power blocks, whatever is there, they are real. They are caused by greed. Greed is the main cause of these acts of transgressions. And it's because of an uncontrollable greed to that people want to dominate even the world. Even if you give someone, a greedy person, the entire world, he will not stop there. That's what greed is.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Islam trains a person, a man, to subdue his greed to the greater benefit of mankind. And it has forbidden interest, and it has abolished the system of earning money from money. The Islamic society cannot tolerate an economic system based upon taking and giving interest. If you have money to spare, give it without any worldly motive, just for the sake of pleasing Allah by helping His creatures. Do not follow those unbelievers who refuse to help poor on the pretext that God could have given them wealth had He wanted so. Okay? They have been condemned by the Quran and by the prophetic sayings. As you can find evidences of this condemnation in the Quran and also in the religious literature. Of course, Islam has prescribed giving alms, giving zakat, and these are methods of subduing the undesirable greed. The commander of faithful Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam says, "At-tama'u yudhhibu al-hikma min qulub al-ulama." Greed makes wisdom leave the learned man's hearts. Okay, so it is just like fire that destroys everything along with it. Okay. Now, there's also another saying from the commander of faithful Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, who says, "Al-haris alladhi yatlubu al-maksaba min ghayri hillaha." A greedy person is the one who demands unlawful gains. So, the world will become a paradise if mankind heeds to this ethical code and changes its attitude accordingly. Also, the commander of faithful Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam has said, whatever poverty and distress in this world is owing to the greed of rich men who do not comply with the rules laid down by Islam about their financial obligations. It is because of the poverty that some people suffer. It is because there are some rich people who deny the poor people their rights.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Division of inheritance is another method by which Islam compels Muslims to distribute the wealth accumulated during a lifetime, during a person's lifetime. And of course, the Quran lays down the detailed rules of its distribution among heirs, but it does not become silent after this. It says that if any poor person is present, give something to him also. So, infaq, there is a very important concept in the Quran which says infaq. Infaq means to give something out of your pocket, something that you like, okay? And it is also a method, infaq is a method of subduing and dominating your greed. Now let's root out the greed from our hearts. Only then this world will be a place to live in. And as long as we do not suppress our desire for more, and as long as we do not suppress our desire for more wealth and for more things, then we will not be able to live a calm life, because a person who is greedy is restless. He does not live a comfortable life. That's the reason why we do not have calm and peace in our life. And that's the reason why there's continued violence, there's continued war, and there's continued bloodshed in the world. All this is because of human greed, because of endless greed. And if people are contented with what they have, and if the people work hard to earn what they do not have through lawful means, of course, there will be peace, there will be calm in the world, and there will be no destruction and no violence across the world. That's all for this session. Inshallah, we will continue with another important topic in the following episode, and that is envy. Inshallah. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. All I need, all I need, all I need, all I need. Oh, 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 oh. All I need, to be all I need. And I know that you see how much you need. Love is all I need.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, has warned lawmakers that QAnon conspiracy theory followers may be on the verge of carrying out more violence in real life on Democrats and others that they perceive, however falsely, to be threats. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Sharon Zhang, journalist. This article is published under the heading, QAnon followers are likely planning more violence against lawmakers, warns FBI. Here's more on the story. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, has warned lawmakers that QAnon conspiracy theory followers may be on the verge of carrying out more violence in real life, and Democrats and others that they perceive, however falsely, to be threats. QAnon followers are evidently growing restless because they believe they can no longer trust the plan referenced in QAnon posts, and that they have an obligation to change from serving as digital soldiers towards engaging in real-world violence, the FBI warns in a document to lawmakers. QAnon followers are conspiracy theorists who follow the word of an anonymous Q online, widely speculated to be fringe right-wing forum, 8chan administrators Jim and Ron Watkins. The conspiracy theory riddle posts by Q have no basis in reality, but they have gained purchase among Donald Trump followers and others on the right. Q often posts what amounts to smear campaigns against Democratic politicians like Hillary Clinton. But Q hasn't posted since December of 2020, and some Q followers are evidently anxious that Q's plan to take down the global cult of mostly liberal politicians and celebrities. The FBI warns in turn that Democrats and others who they perceive to be enemies of the cause could be in danger. The lack of direction and action from QAnon may lead the digital soldiers to harm perceived members of the cult, such as Democrats and other political opposition, instead of continually waiting Q's promised actions, which have not occurred. The FBI document reads, the threat from militant QAnon followers is pronounced, the agency writes, following the group's large presence at the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. FBI agents have arrested over 20 self-proclaimed QAnon followers in connection with the Capitol attack, though previous reporting has found that a belief in QAnon was one of the most common shared traits among the Trump mob from that day. QAnon followers' participation in the Capitol breach underscores how the current environment likely will continue to act as a catalyst for some to begin accepting the legitimacy of violent action, the document says. A classified version of the FBI threat assessment was circulated among legislators in February, CNN reports. But lawmakers have been frustrated with the FBI for not investigating the conspiracy theory in more depth, noting that it's an increasingly large threat to domestic safety and democracy. Senator Martin Heinrich questioned FBI Director Christopher Wray in a hearing in April, asking why the agency cannot or won't tell the American people directly about the threat of QAnon in relation to the threat assessment. Wray responded that the agency is only investigating the conspiracy theory in relation to federal crimes, such as those committed on January 6th. said ignoring the growing threat of right-wing extremists has severely hampered the agency's abilities to prevent violence before, as is evidenced by the very capital attack that they are now investigating. Despite the fact that Heinrich had requested the FBI to look into the threat of QAnon in December, and the fact that at least one government agency had sent them a warning of the violence to come on January 6th, the FBI never prepared a formal report on the threat prior to the day. At the time, FBI officials said that they didn't want to impend upon free speech, but as NPR reported in January, that didn't stop them from issuing warnings over protests from Black Lives. And despite the fact that QAnon supporters and right-wing extremists have been on the rise for many years and pose a huge threat in the U.S., the FBI has spent an outsized amount of time investigating left-wing protesters and advocates, even though the right is responsible for nearly all modern domestic terrorism.
Africa Today.
This month of June marks the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The charismatic leader was revered in Iran and across the world, including in African countries. Now, the incarcerated leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, says the thoughts of Imam Khomeini have remained relevant even after his demise.
And the thought before this world is the thought of Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini is alive because his thoughts are very relevant to this time.
Hello, and a warm welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today. I'm your presenter, Mubarak Kenya. Today, we are focusing on the impact of the thoughts of Imam Khomeini in Africa and how he inspired African nations in their struggle against apartheid and neocolonialism. So join us as our experts give us an incisive analysis on this subject.
Imam Khomeini in Africa. One of the stated goals of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, led by Imam Khomeini in 1979, was to fight against racism and to support people of color. Imam Khomeini fulfilled his promise immediately after the victory of the Islamic Revolution when he issued an order to cut off Iran's ties with the apartheid regime in South Africa. This decision inspired the struggle for freedom and emancipation in South Africa. After his release from prison, the late Nelson Mandela traveled to Iran 2 times, and in both trips, he met with the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei.
Now, during his first visit to Iran in 1992, Nelson Mandela emphasized that Imam Khomeini was a source of inspiration for the South African people in their anti-apartheid activities. The leader of the Islamic Revolution records here on what transpired during his meeting with Mandela. Now, for more on how Imam Khomeini inspired the people of Africa, we are joined here by Ms. Suhaila Ibrahim Zakzaki, the daughter of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, the leader of the Islamic Movement of Nigeria. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also with us here today is Said Husseini, the director of Islamic Center for Africa. Thank you for accepting our invitation.
It's a pleasure.
So let's start off with Ms. Suhaila Zakzaki. Now, can you first tell us about your personal acquaintance with the thoughts of Imam Khomeini?
The Imam, primarily with how we view the Imam, is a very, as someone that is a role model and an example for us for what Islamic, an Islamic struggle looks like, a struggle to bring about an Islamic system looks like. Imam was probably one of the, or the only actually example of that, that actually achieved success. Because while there is many other who had Islamic revolutionary views and whatnot, with the revolution of Iran, that was the first time that we saw in this world a success of such thing in our time today, right? So Imam was that kind of, is that kind of example for us to this day, and especially with his emphasis on Islam and politics and the fact that those are not two separate things, and also Islam in many other aspects of life, like economics and other aspects of life, government and everything.
Thank you very much, Ms. Suhaila Zakzaki, for that.
The starting point of Imam Khomeini's proximity to the people of Africa after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution was his decision to cut off Iran's ties with the apartheid regime in South Africa. This has been touted one of the Imam's strategic decisions made even before the victory of the revolution. Imam had already said, if the revolution attains victory, we will ties with the apartheid regime in South Africa.
Now, Mr. Husseini, as we know, immediately after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini ordered the cutting of ties between Iran and South African apartheid regime. Now, how did this move inspire the liberation movements in that country?
I was speaking to icons of the struggle in South Africa. I was speaking to Nelson Mandela himself. He was saying to me that when the Islamic revolution in Iran was happening, we actually had all of our hopes lost before that. We were thinking it will be impossible for us to deal with the apartheid state. This state is not going to dim, and this state is not going to go away. We were thinking about other ways how to cope and all of that. But when the victory of Islamic revolution happened, we say, if it is possible for Iranian to remove a regime which was 2,500 years rooted, we also in South Africa, we will be able to do the same to apartheid regime.
Mr. Hussein Iver, the director of Islamic Center for Africa, stay tuned for more.
The Islamic Revolution of Iran under the leadership of Imam Khomeini created tremendous change for women. Iranian women are free to participate in various social, political, educational, and economic activities in conformity with Islamic tenets. One such recent example is Zahran Emati, an Iranian female Paralympic and Olympic archer. She is now recognized as one of the most inspiring women in the world, winning the 2021 International Women's Day Recognition Award.
We have our own culture and specific dress codes and cannot abandon it because we believe in it. Me and my fellow female athletes proved that we can take part in world sports events with our special dress code and win medals.
The progress made by women in Iran has inspired Muslim women from other parts of the world. In Nigeria recently, an 8 months pregnant woman won a gold medal. Now she took part in the competition wearing the Islamic hijab. Now, Ms. Suhaila Zakzaki, how have Imam Khomeini's viewpoints on women in Islam contributed to the awakening of Muslim women in Africa?
Imam's revolution and the fact that he emphasized on the role of women in society in the Islamic revolution, subsequently in building the country when the revolution succeeded, and in his many writings about Muslim women's role in public society in Islam, that has directly affected a lot of people, I believe, throughout the continent, and definitely in some even ways may have affected others indirectly. But I believe that is one of that is definitely a very great contribution to the idea that Muslim women should participate in public Islamic life as well, not just pray and, you know, pay attention to their relationship with God and not have any say or in anything, or even speak, let's say, about Islamic matters, which was a prevalent thought before that. And I believe that to this day, that is the case, that Imam's views on women still influence in a lot of people throughout Africa.
Thank you, Ms. Suhaila Zakzaki, for that. Now we shall take a short break, and when we come back, we shall continue with our discussion on the impact of Imam Khomeini's thoughts in Africa. Stay with us.
Imam Khomeini in Africa.
Imam Khomeini's message resonated well with Africans who were inspired by his firm stand against arrogant powers and unflinching support for the oppressed and downtrodden nations. An African Muslim scholar explains here on how Imam Khomeini inspired African nations. Let's take a listen.
Imam Khomeini, his relationship with Africa was on the basis of humanity, that an African person is a human being like other human beings. He came with a very important terminology when he was talking to Africans and to other people about Africa by introducing a word, al-mustadhaf, which this particular terminology was almost forgotten, even though the Holy Quran in Surah Al-Qasas says clearly, وَنُرِيدُ أَنَّ مُنَّ عَلَى الَّذِينَ اسْتُضْعِفُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ. We want to make those people who are deprived on the land, to make them a'imma, leaders. Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi alayhi, came with this particular terminology to say that if you look at the world today, you will see two types of people. There are those who are oppressors and those who are oppressed. And oppressed are mustadha'af. So he was talking to people of Africa and other parts of the world as mustadha'af, to tell them that, remember, Allah in the Holy Quran will want to make you as leaders, so wake up.
Well, Mr. Hosseini, African people are currently engaged in the struggle against yesterday's colonialists, who are today's neo-colonialists. Now, how can the ideas and thoughts of Imam Khomeini be useful in this regard?
Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, taught the Iranian nation how to fight against Shah regime. If the people of Africa also take their lessons from Imam Khomeini, I think they are going to be more determined in their struggle against the new colonialism which is taking over Africa in all over the show. And that is the sense of independence, being themselves, studying more, extending their education, thinking about their destiny, and lean on their own capacity and their capabilities and their financial abilities, and work for their own nation, don't allow other people to interfere in their affairs. I think these are the principles that Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, managed to teach the Iranian nation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hosseini, for that insight.
The African continent has the natural resources and commercial power to become the richest continent in the world. But oppression, bribery, and exploitation by the Western powers hinder its development. Neocolonialism is no doubt the number one problem to Africa's economic development. While it is true that African countries gained independence from the imperialist Western countries, but neocolonialism remains a major challenge.
Now, Ms. Suhaila Zakzaki, as an African, what lessons do you think African nations can get from Imam Khomeini in combating neocolonialism?
Well, the Islamic Revolution in Iran, I would say, is in a way almost parallel to the struggle against neocolonialism, considering at the time, let's say, the Shah in Iran, while an Iranian ruler over Iranian people, was heavily influenced by people from outside who wanted to benefit from that kind of influence and control over the Shah to their benefits, which is no different than what we see currently in throughout the continent today. It's no different from that. It is pretty much exactly what neocolonialism is and what we are living through, what is our reality today. And so in the approach that Imam had to that, to standing up against that kind of system, I believe that we have a lot to learn from that, and we do look to that as an example in so many ways. Even with the Islamic movement in Nigeria, I believe we look to that heavily as an example and an inspiration.
Now, Mr. Husseini, we have heard there Ms. Suhaila Zakzaki talking about how Imam Khomeini inspired the Islamic movement in Nigeria. Now, can you briefly elaborate on Imam Khomeini's role in the awakening and unity of Muslims in Africa?
Imam Khomeini, right from beginning, was that we are not Shias, not Sunnis, we are Muslims, we are striving toward Islamic revolution, Islamic republic, and for us, we should not fight amongst each other. The Shias are the brothers of the Sunnis, and the Sunnis are the Shia brothers. So those people who had access to the teachings of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, they are those people who have listened to his advice, and today they are the supporters of Islamic revolution. And alhamdulillah, we're enjoying the support of so many Muslim brothers across the globe. The Sunnis are backing the Shias are backing the Sunnis.
Thank you very much for your time and insight, Said Husseini, the director of the Islamic Center for Africa.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been involved in many humanitarian activities across Africa, including setting up colleges and universities, medical clinics, and agricultural projects which directly benefit the masses. One such project is the Iran Clinic in Ghana's capital, Accra. Speaking during the inauguration of the refurbished clinic, the country's vice president lauded the contributions of the Iranian government to the health sector of Ghana.
The Iran Clinic has got a long history in Ghana, and it is really one of the benefits and the lasting benefits, I hope, of this close relationship between the government and people of Iran and the government of people of Ghana. And I think that what we are seeing here in the Iran clinic, 300 patients at least every day come through here. Every day, at least 300 patients. And this is why it comes up to close to 100,000 every year. That is a huge contribution to healthcare in Ghana that the Red Crescent, Iranian Red Crescent, is providing. Huge contribution.
Students, let me say assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh. The essence of coming here this morning to interact with you, much has been said by your head teacher. And the issue here this morning is that my ministry, that is the Ministry of Inner City and Zongo Development, is in collaboration with the Iran Clinic to help bring medical attention to your doorsteps.
Iran's development projects in Africa were one of the topics during a roundtable held in Uganda last year to discuss Imam Khomeini's impact on Africa. Let's take a listen to one of the participants.
We are seeing schools, universities opened in African capitals. They were not there before the revolution. A country like Iran giving support, and it was very wealthy by then, giving support to other countries like it is doing now, it was not there. I've said politically, it stood with the Africans against racism in South Africa. We have seen, even politically, opening embassies. All these embassies we're seeing in Africa were not there before the revolution. When this revolution came, and they wanted to know more about problems of the African communities, African countries, all of these embassies were opened so that they interact with the populations, get how we can exchange, cultural exchange, commerce, and political integration.
Now, Ms. Suhaila Zakzaki, how have the thoughts of Imam Khomeini contributed to the progress of Muslims in Nigeria?
especially when the Islamic Revolution succeeded, this brought about a kind of, in some cases very directly, like I can say, for example, in the Islamic movement and for other people as well, but also in some cases very indirectly, that people are much more, I believe, comfortable with comfortably expressing interest in an Islamic system, potentially in Islam, not just as a private thing for people, for individuals, and also for Islam, even in a political sense and other things. And I think that has had a great effect on Nigeria, especially when we look at the Islamic movement, which is heavily influenced by Imam and the Imam's revolution and the Imam's writings and the Imam's thoughts and everything, and his whole life entirely, basically.
Imam Khomeini had unique leadership qualities which endeared him to the masses in Iran and across the world. He introduced himself as the servant of the people and considered the people a source of blessing. The Imam was a serious supporter of the poor and the oppressed, and he forcefully and bitterly rejected economic inequality and aristocracy. In one of his previous speeches, the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria says the world needs to emulate Imam Khomeini, as he was a unique leader.
Some people think that just as we have Imam Khomeini in Iran, other Muslim countries should have their own Khomeini type leader. You know, I heard someone was saying they need their own Khomeini. And they need Khomeinis. Look, the world, the whole world, the entire world needs only one Khomeini, and it has one. What it remains for the world is to follow the teaching of Imam Khomeini. You cannot talk of Imam Khomeini being a former leader or an older leader. He's still the leader. And alhamdulillah, he has got a successor in the person of Sayyid Ali Khamenei, Hafizahullah, where the teaching of the Imam continue as if it is the Imam himself is alive.
Well, that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today, and it's been great having you with us. Tell us what you think about our show by dropping us a line through our social media handle. And on behalf of my colleagues here at Africa Today, goodbye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the issues that are raised during the Islamic upbringing of our children. To help us with our questions, we have the dear and beloved Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. We are going to have this comprehensive look at a positive upbringing of our children. Sayyid, salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. It's always nice to have you here. Thanks for giving us your time.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. The pleasure is all mine. I'm glad to be here with you.
Thank you. So, Sayyid, on our last episode, we took a general look at what we're trying to do here. We're trying to take a comprehensive approach to the Islamic upbringing of our children. And the key word for this series is positive upbringing. That's what we're trying to do. But generally speaking, what methods are there that we should learn when it comes to raising our children?
All right. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. I would like to begin with something that you said in the last program that we had, which was you said, you know, because the process of upbringing causes parents a lot of stress, right? So how do we cope with that stress? So before we start with our kids, and I think we've stressed this point like in many, many episodes before, that in order for you to be a better educator, there are a few things you need to keep in mind, right? So that itself will relieve you of the stress, okay? As an educator, as a parent, as someone who wants to educate, you have to keep in mind a few things, right? One is that you are responsible for your kids' upbringing, not the teachers, not the school, not the friends, not the house, not the seminary. You are responsible, first and foremost. He is a trust from Allah given to you, and you have to raise that child, and then you have to have that certainty within you that it is your responsibility, because sometimes when we don't accept responsibility, it causes me and you what? A bit of stress. Like, what should I do? This and that. Because you're not putting yourself in the role. You're not playing or taking the role of teaching or educating or upbringing your child in a very certain manner. As we say, you don't have yaqeen qat'i that it is your role. He's like, you know what? He will learn. I mean, I'll send him to school, he will learn. I will take him to the house. I will take him to Quran classes. I will take him to the school. They will teach him. Which meaning what? You are taking the responsibility away. But when it comes to you, then later on, when this backfires and you feel the responsibility, you fall under that immense stress. But when from the beginning you take it as your role, as your duty to educate your child, and you have that certainty in it, it relieves you with time, obviously. It relieves you of that out of that stress. That's one. Two,
can I just stop you right there? There's that mentality as well. You might have heard this. Al-ga'i rabbi. That the ground will raise your child. Just leave him be. Just give him his food, and he will be raised himself. So that kind of mentality, if our grown-ups say it, which indeed they might, I heard that myself, we should put that aside completely.
Obviously, like I said, I don't want to give figures. I don't want to throw figures around. But the majority of people, that's their approach to their kids. It's okay. He will learn. You know, I spoke to many parents, like, he's too young. Recently, we went in a barbecue with brothers, and one of the brothers, he brought his kids, and they were two young kids. They were, you know, around maybe five, six. And they were extremely active, and we were, like, in a farm, and they destroyed the farm.
Oh.
And I said to the brother, like, you should learn to teach your kids. He's like, no, they're too young. I'm like, that's precisely the point. Uh-huh. That's what you need to teach them. Leave them when they're old, you will not be able to control them. If you can't control them now, it's going to be a hassle controlling them later. Right? So this is where we have to... So as parents, we have to take that responsibility and understand it and accept it from the beginning.
We'll sort that out during the break. Don't go away. We'll continue this discussion just after the break.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. So we're talking about the methods of a positive upbringing of children. So in the previous section, we talked about responsibility. First things first, accept and understand that this is your responsibility, first and foremost, to raise these children. It's not the responsibility of your neighbors, the school, the seminary, the local cleric, or anything like that.
Precisely. So this is homework for you. So you said you have a young child, right? So you have to start from now, from tomorrow, programming your mind that I am responsible. I am responsible.
Keep saying that exactly. To yourself.
Exactly. Inshallah, we'll talk about that later. We'll talk about repetition because it's a part of upbringing and programming the children. A second thing that I wanted to mention also is that you need to understand that you will not be able to have a better child or a good child unless you make yourself a better example and a role model. So forget about having a child that is perfect if you are not perfect. You look at your mistakes, what mistakes you have, fix them, rectify them, and so the child could learn from you. So the child, not only he needs a mentor, that wants someone to teach him, but he also needs a role model. And automatically, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has embedded in kids and children that they automatically look up towards the fathers. Like the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he says, if you give your child a promise, never break it, because he looks at you as you are his Lord. So at this age, the child doesn't know Allah yet. The only Allah he knows is you. So if you give him a word and you break your word, you demolish that picture of him having you being in his creator. It goes away. It vanishes. So he says, لا تعدهم وتخالفهم. Do not give them a promise and then you break it. So you have to put yourself in that position where you are the role model. So you look at yourself, say, okay, what do I have? Things are wrong. Do I lie, for example? Even for a joking matter. You know, like someone calls you on the phone or calls your wife on the phone and they ask for you, like, tell her I'm not here, tell her I'm not, and you make that sign, all right? And if the child sees that, you pretty much practically has taught him how to lie, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So these things, you take them away yourself, all these negative attributes that you have, take them away, fix yourself, make yourself a better role model, then accept the fact that you are his teacher, and then you are set.
Okay, now we're going to get into all of these in detail, right? But I just want to ask a quick question here in like 1 minute. Like we're all quite old. I'm 30 years old myself, mm-hmm. and there are problems that I probably will not be able to solve anymore. It's just too late. I've been living with them for 30 years. Mm-hmm. They're going to be there. And it's very important for me that my child doesn't inherit this through my behavior.
Yeah.
What can we do about those?
Look, there's nothing that you cannot fix, okay? We have many ways, like even through psychology, we have so many ways in trying to get you to get rid of old habits and accept new habits. I'll give you an example. The month of Ramadan, right? You have, for example, a smoking addict who smokes a pack, 2 packs a day, right? Or they chain smoke. In the month of Ramadan, they stop. If you come to them anywhere beside the month of Ramadan, they said, I cannot stop smoking. In the month of Ramadan, they stop. Why? They don't read Quran during the whole year. In the month of Ramadan, they read a chapter every single day. So we do have the capacity to get rid of old habits and accept new habits, but we need to have, obviously, the will.
Motivation.
Obviously, we need to have that will and the motivation behind it to do it. Having a better child is the motivation that you need to accept. So you say, you know what? I need to stop it under all costs.
Yeah, all right, thanks. Let's take a break and we'll be back to talk about the methods of a positive upbringing. So just before the break, the first thing was remember that you are responsible. It's your job. And the second method was to fix yourself in order to fix your children. We'll be back after the break. Don't go away.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, a righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise.